Hey, welcome back to Trailblaze. I'm Jamal Simmons.
And I'm Nayara Haque. Trailblaze, as you know, is about the America that we are becoming. It's the people, the politics and ideas, everything that's making it happen. We have gone into deep thoughts about voting demographics, voting rights, what's happening. And Jamal, So many things I want to talk to you about have happened in the last couple of days. I definitely want to chat with you about this kerfluffle that's going on with President Barack Obama, the first Black president, having talked directly to Black men. Seems to be an issue. I don't know what's on your mind today.
Yeah, look, we got to talk about that because I think that is something that is blowing up the interwebs, as they say. So I want to talk about that. I also want to talk about the strange things that are happening out on the campaign trail. You know, one of the things that people have been talking about, which, you know, we can get into all of this, we got to talk about the opportunity agenda for Black men, which is what the vice president put out this week. I want to talk about this sort of crazy thing about the enemy within. Did you see Donald Trump say that he thinks that the liberal lefties are actually more dangerous than China or Russia or the other enemies we might have? So we should talk about that. And then lastly, what about this thing with the multimedia campaigns that took place this week where we had Donald Trump on stage jamming out to music? Well, jamming out is kind of overstatement.
Okay, so I'm tracking
Donald Trump on stage with music.
I'm tracking the other topics that you talked about. And I also wanted to get into maybe some boomer bashing. I don't know if we can see because it's democracy messaging. But you, I did actually miss this about Donald Trump. What did Donald Trump do?
If you want a boomer bash, watching Donald Trump on stage trying to dance to YMCA is all you really need for boomer bashing. But he spent about 30 minutes this week on stage at a rally just listening to music like he was at home with his bros. Like, you know, hey guys, what about this jam?
Okay, so Donald Trump continues to do rallies. They're rambling. None of his advisors can get him to talk about policy. I think we finally settled that this is no longer an election about policy issues and who's going to deliver the best ideas. There's even this whole thing about they both want a tax credit for childcare, or rather the child tax credit, but which echelon is it going to apply to? I feel like we're beyond that, but I'm not sure we're at that point where dancing on stage is helpful. So like Donald doesn't know how to dance. What are we talking about?
I think it's a little bit of this.
I am clearly, I have missed a video.
It's the old man lip bite with like a kind of railroad train hand movement. It's kind of a weird thing. But you got to see it. I mean, listen, for those who haven't seen it, I hope you take a look at it.
He really just does whatever he feels like in the moment.
Whatever he feels like. This is like free flow, free thinking campaigning. And the problem is, like you said, he's not talking to 60 Minutes. He's not talking to any like mainstream media outlet, only doing the conservative media outlets. And then he's on stage supposedly doing a Q&A. And then he transitions from the Q&A with the audience because apparently he thought it was boring. And so he just kicks into some, you know, Ave Maria, because Pavarotti is always a bigger crowd pleaser. Anyway,
I would put Pavarotti up there with arugula. Like, actually, no, Pavarotti to me is a little higher than the arugula issue, but right there with windsurfing. Like, what? So, okay.
All right. So then there's that.
We should not be surprised, right? Like, we should not be surprised. And it is true that Donald Trump has disappeared in a way that Kamala Harris hasn't. Like, she used to get the criticism for not doing mainstream media interviews when they just are doing this blitz of going out to media outlets where people actually are listening to something other than politics and news and are now realizing and connecting what we're experiencing in the election and our systems and connecting that back to real life. So I think going where the voters are is always a smart election turnout strategy. But Trump is not doing that. He's not doing the hard interviews. He's still doing the rallies, I guess, because they feel good. But now it's just another example how it's about him. It's not about a strategy. It's not about a consistent form of leadership. If he wants to stand there and just, hey, you know, forget you all don't need to participate and talk or do anything. Forget about what you all have to say. Let's just stand here and listen to some random ass music.
Right. Let's just jam.
Sure.
So here's the connecting thread.
Black voters? Like, what?
Right. But here's the correcting thread. Well, he's not. Yeah. So here's the connecting thread. So then you have Vice President Harris, who's on stage, who's giving a speech also the same night. She's giving a speech talking to her crowd of voters. But what she does is then she says, let's go to the videotape, right? Let's go to the clips. And she starts playing crazy Trump clips at her rally so that people can understand exactly what it is they're running against. Because I think what they have figured out inside the campaign is that people don't actually see Donald Trump in full. We keep saying, watch the rallies, mm-hmm. but nobody watches the rallies anymore because they're not really covered on mainstream television. And so only the faithful, the GOP faithful, get it. So Donald Trump can seem sort of rational and normal. And listen, this is where the Trump team is smart. They don't put him on 60 Minutes. They don't put him on mainstream mm-hmm. TV because they don't want you to actually see and listen to Donald Trump. They don't want you to hear the crazy. So instead, he only saves that for his faithful at these rallies and mm-hmm. on these conservative outlets. So Harris and the Harris campaign said, no, you don't get to hide out among your friends. Let's show everybody what you're doing in the dark. And they put Donald Trump on screen at a rally for everybody to see it. I think the more that American people see what Donald Trump is really up to, the more it's going to matter.
Well, because we have forgotten, right, what the first few months of the first Trump presidency were like. And that's before there actually was even this Project 2025 plan, right? They have consistently... conservatives and Republicans in the United States and overseas, they will tell you what they are going to do. It's very straightforward. Mm-hmm. It's not, they will tell you there is a plan with 140 former Trump administration officials, right? They will tell you people who identify, I guess, as liberal, like, oh, no, that could never happen. That could never happen in America. No, nobody would ever say that. So yes, bad stuff did happen in the first 4 years. It was a very erratic, very anxiety-ridden experience for Americans on top of COVID, all of this. But the way it gets discussed and platformed and packaged makes, because those are normal ways to share information, makes the whole thing seem normal. But this is my question. Part of what media and journalists in particular were trying to correct for was the open sharing of platforming of Trump rallies, because they weren't getting fact check. It was essentially free airtime and like, oh, let's see what crazy thing he says next. And it ended up being free message sharing. So we're now the opposite problem right now, which is that people aren't seeing what Trump is actually doing, you know, 20 days before the election.
Right. No, it's absolutely right. And so what's happening is Trump is being protected from himself, right? He's being protected from all the things that he says. And so he can communicate to his followers in a very specific way mm-hmm. on the channels that they watch and they listen to without having the rest of us be exposed to it, which is something that is...
That
I think in the end,
working
to his advantage. Yeah. Exactly. He doesn't want mass market attention this time.
No, and that's right. That's it right there. He doesn't want the mass market attention. He needs to hold his 47-48%, get some folks on the margins. And I want to talk about the margins, because we've done a lot of this, which is different than marginalized people, right? That's like margins and marginalized people are different. All right, you were going to say, I interrupted you.
Yeah, no. I just want, before we go there, I did want to get to what Harris was playing on the stage, right?
Yes.
So she does these events. She puts up the screen and she says, here's what Donald Trump is saying that you're missing. And I took some quotes because I wanted to get it from the NBC story. And he says, I always say we have two enemies. We have the outside enemy, and then we have the enemy from within. And the enemy from within, in my opinion, is more dangerous than China, Russia, and all these countries. Trump added that a smart president can handle his adversaries. And he said, when asked about the upcoming election, Trump tried to tamp down those fears that chaos could again ensue. So what he says is, not from the side that votes from Trump, but that we're going to have violence. But then he says, I think the bigger problem is the enemy from within. We have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics. Any unrest, Trump says, should be very easily handled by, if necessary, the National Guard, were really necessary by the military, because they can't let that happen. And when they ask him, he goes, the thing that's tough to handle are these lunatics that we have inside, like Adam Schiff, right? So he's not talking about immigrants, which is what people have said. He's not talking about Antifa, you know, the thing that he always sort of drummed up. He's talking about very specific elected officials who have tried to hold him accountable. Mm-hmm. And what do people think when Donald Trump starts going after elected officials, when he starts going after progressive groups, when he starts going after people who by name or by identity or by group and by interest, what do people think is next? What does Glenn Youngkin, the governor of Virginia, think is next, who went out and tried to defend this the other day with Jake Tapper? He's coming after Republicans next, because if you disagree with him, it doesn't matter what your affiliation is. When they were, when Mike Pence was in the Capitol, his vice president, and people were saying, hang Mike Pence outside, and they told Donald Trump they were coming for Mike Pence, he said, so what? right?
And
he
those
doesn't care.
People, right? Those are not the problematic people. Let's be clear. Those people did not get the National Guard called out on them. In fact, we had the National Guard of DC, which, here's a technical issue, has to be activated by the executive branch, federal executive branch. They cannot get activated by a governor because there is no governor for the city of DC. They're the closest ones. The head of the National Guard, under sworn testimony, said he was contemplating disobeying orders and effectively putting everybody's career on the line to say, all right, guys, we need to go and we need to get there and calm this ish down. Luckily, Maryland and Virginia, two different states, got there first because the White House and the Pentagon, under political influence, did not activate the National Guard for almost the entire day. People have forgotten. We had the National Guard sleeping in the halls of Congress.
Yeah, I'll tell you what happened, because we have a friend who was in the National Guard, the DC National Guard, and I know exactly what happened, which was that they got asked to, like, basically assemble, right? So not technically called up, but they got asked to assemble. They all went to their stations. They all got dressed, right? They all went in battle-ready uniform, but they had to just sit there and wait for the order, right? So the idea was once the order happened, they could go like that. Yep. But that's not what – but it didn't happen for a long time, so which supports your point, which is like they didn't get the federal order. So the DC National Guard was basically sitting on its hands while they were rioting and attacking the Capitol, attacking police officers, and – defecating, shitting in the halls of Congress.
And now fast forward 4 more years, and the formality of planning that has happened with people who know how to execute and plan ahead versus the earlier version of, right, people also forget this part of the Trump administration, like, well, if you put some adults around him, the adults can manage, the president of the United States. And you had generals, you had all sorts of experienced statesmen, chiefs of staff. Nope. He is a personality unto himself. He is fundamentally the personality type that is a chaos agent. You don't need to play Dungeons and Dragons to understand how that works. And he is also the textbook authoritarian. And I know this is not the ideal way to message to the American public. So I want to get the definitional pieces out, and then we can get to how it's actually translating out in the field in ways that do resonate. Biden team started out early talking about the soul of democracy, right? What it means to be a democracy on the world stage. And, you know, it's now become a buzzword of its own with no meaning behind it. But that idea of how do you knit together a social fabric of different types of people, whether they're different states, and have some cohesion or sense of a national identity, number one. And number two, how do you do that locally as a community? Whether it is Irish immigrants, whether it is Chinese immigrants, right? There is a history of the Statue of Liberty that the United States still wants to honor and adhere to as we're perfecting our systems. That the answer that Trump gives to all of that is not a give and take. It is not trust a system and watch it play out and, you know, put a little bit of yourself aside so you can have group gain. The answer Trump gives is majoritarian rule, power rules. And if we need to use militancy or some kind of weaponry on our own civilians and citizens, we will do that. That is no longer something we use on the enemy overseas. The U.S. military, he has made it very clear, he sees that as perfectly okay to use against Americans, like domestic. Forget about local police.
Yeah.
Forget about that. That whole idea of what that community policing even can look like. It's you can do that. And that gets support. The idea that people aren't, that doesn't appeal to people. No, of course it appeals to people. It appeals to people all through history.
Yeah, it all sounds good in theory, but let me give you, like, this is a very small example of this, right? But this is like an example from, I'm thinking about this from last week. I'm talking to the coach of my kids' Little League soccer team, and he is talking about tracking kids' playing time and making sure all the kids get enough playing time, blah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. Imagine if there was one parent who was there who paid for everything, who was like 6'7", 400 pounds, and was just like, coach, I want my kid to play all the time. Right. And so that kid has to play, whether or not that kid's doing well, whether or not the kid's scoring, whether or not the kid's playing defense. But the dad is just so strong that he makes everybody else have to comply. The team loses, right? Because we have made this decision purely based on power. So here's the thing. when we all participate, this is supposed to be the thing about democracy. The democracy is that none of us ever has so much power that all of us have to be subjected to it, and that we can all sort of make decisions together. Sometimes we'll get those decisions right. Sometimes we'll get those decisions wrong. But over the course of the country's process, we will tend to get it right. And what happens in countries like China and Russia and these places where they don't have participatory democracy is one group of people makes all the decisions, they can't be challenged. And even if they're wrong, the whole ship goes down with that decision that's being made by that small group of people.
Well,
that one
this is where the victim narrative is so important in that, right? So somehow you have that power to tell everybody else on your team what will and will not happen. And you're like, all right, you know, I just want to play. And if this is the only team I can play in, or the only league that we have, okay, I guess my kid has to go along with this. And I'll tell my kid, you know, just figure it out. Don't, you know, just don't raise a kerfluffle. You still get to play, right? Like, you're still there. But that person then turns into the victim. That's how they say they need to have power. I need the continued power, because if I didn't have power, you all would trample all over me. Right. And that's the grievance, the victimhood that Trump plays on so magically, even though none of his followers, you know, large as opposed to donors, but the mass public following didn't have any of the privileges and access that he did growing up. No Trump supporter voter would be able to go through 11 bankruptcies and still be considered a functioning member of society, let alone elevated to this level. But it makes them feel like their challenges in life can be blamed. They can be blamed on something other than maybe you just made some mistakes. Maybe
so the social scientists there's a term for this, which is prototypicality threat, right? So we all believe, this happens to people normally, you believe that the person who is best qualified to do what you do is someone who comes from a similar place or has similar training is what you do, right? So I'm the prototypical version. My path is a prototypical path. I want other people to do it. The problem is that now what happens is people are now starting to feel that people who are like them aren't going to be, are being discriminated against because they see it happening other places. They feel like, oh, well, this person is different and they got to do it. They didn't have the same background I did. So this is what happens very often in diversity training, right? Or diversity hiring. People will say, oh, I don't have a problem hiring a woman of African-American or Latino woman or a brown woman to come and work in my shop. As long as she has served in the military, went to an Ivy League school, has a law degree, and, you know, volunteers for the United Club or whatever on the weekends.
And when
as long as she's done all those things, then she should
guess
come.
What? For right? many years.
But how many people are going to fit that mold?
But okay, so the ones who did all those achievements, and on top of that, had a family, raised children, did all of those things, the black women who have done that, what happens when they enter those suites and rooms, right? They are overqualified to then present at the standard. What happens is it gets told, oh, well, then you were just an affirmative action case. Like, you're not really, your credential really the same thing as what I did.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And then you get, you know, this all this off discrimination. I call prototypicality threat is like the handmaiden. It's the street drug for culture fit, right?
Yeah.
It's like culture fit is the street name for prototypicality threat. Like, we want you to not only like come here and do all the things that we did in order to get here, but when you get here, you have to perform the way that we performed, right? So here's this woman who's here. Like, God forbid she has kids that she has to think about. God forbid she has parents she has to think about. God forbid she has a household she has to run, or she has to do anything else that's different. So that she doesn't have, you know, a quote unquote, a wife at home or somebody who's like a spouse who's taking care of everything. She doesn't have like a housekeeping service to keep her house. So the thing is, the rest of us who are not wealthy, who are not, you know, privileged, have a bunch of other things that we have to manage when we come into spaces. And if we don't have some allowance for the fact that people appreciate our differences and that we're going to be able to contribute, even if we have to contribute, like, you know, I'm going to be online, I'm going to be offline between 5 and 7 because that's when I have to feed my kids, or between 5 and 8 because I feed my kids and put them to bed. But then I'll be back online from like 9 to midnight, right? Mm-hmm. I'll get everything else done. But if you don't have an allowance for that, no, you have to be online till 8 p.m., then you're never going to have people with different experiences participate. And if we don't have everybody participating, we're actually going to be a weaker nation because we have to have that full 360 viewpoint about what's going on in the world.
Well, you do need what comes from the data points that come from the variety of those experiences, right? Particularly if you've already maxed out on serving one group the rest of the groups are still there. Now, the traditional answer by the J.D. Rockefellers and even the conservative parties has been, well, just create an education system that trains workers. Make sure you always have workers, and then the rest of us will be, you know, the power. We have the power. That is also changing. But the irony is the people pulling out of that one system of training workers for new generations are a lot of white Christian folks, right? I'm like, oh, the system is actually kind of designed for you, but you, it's almost like when suddenly now other people can access the public pool, you're just going to go and make your private pools and drain the public one. So, okay, got it. That's what's happening now.
Absolutely. But here's what happens in the world, right? The reality is it's sort of like a royal family that intermarries for generations. They begin to have the DNA degrades, right? Once you begin to have these defects that pop up inside of these families.
It's called hybrid vigor. Hybrid vigor is a genetic term.
Okay, I'm glad you got it right. But that can happen to societies, right? Yeah. The more only the elites are the ones who do everything, what you actually have is innovation that begins to like degrade the idea for innovation. Mm-hmm. And so you got to have new people coming into the stream. This is like the history of how America had done well, is like you have the opportunity for somebody who doesn't have a lot, because necessity is the mother of invention, mm-hmm. right? Somebody who doesn't have a lot to create something new, and then other people flock to that thing. And yeah, people with money and elites come and invest in it, and they make money off of it, and the society brings in new ideas over and over again. If you don't have a ladder that allows people who are trying to innovate and do things in new ways to come up, what happens is the culture of innovation begins to lower. And so you mm-hmm. don't have new things. You don't have new ideas. And over time, that is the way America survives.
Well, this is where, right, the fundamental shift from Reagan immigration theory to what we see now as dominant in the Republican Party. Who are you going to give that ladder to, right? The idea of letting in certain types of people based on preconceived notions of what certain looks or ethnicities and what that can be. And Trump, once again, very clear, just last week the New York Times headline was kind of bonkers on this, where they said, oh, Trump has a proclivity for, genetic discussions. I'm like, no. He has a proclivity for eugenics and random theories about how intelligence works in white people. That is literally Aryan nation stuff. That is a proclivity. That is not science and how actually the stuff works. So that is, right, like the language just gets watered down from any actual substance and meaning and used in the same way. You saw this in the Supreme Court decisions about Roe v. Wade. You look at the footnotes and it says domestic labor supply. That's why we can't have abortions, because America needs a domestic labor supply of what? Unwanted children, or children who couldn't be provided for and taken care of by their families or by society. So I'm sorry, do you want to open up workhouses again? Because actually Sarah Huckabee Sanders is governor. She's like, yeah, 13-year-olds can work in factories.
I was going to say, they're like, let them do that.
Right. So all of this connects, but you said something that I want to bring back to J.D. Vance, because he's the one who's, Trump's not going away, but at some point he's going to die, right? Like, unless he manages to, figure out cryogenics and is here till he's for the next 40 years. But J.D. Vance made a point of saying he's only 40 years old. I'm 40 years old. Like, I'm just getting started. He did this.
Yeah, but I will tell you, the job that you want the least, if you want to be president of the United States, is the nominee for vice president in the Republican Party. There has only been one vice presidential nominee in like the last 100 years who has made it even to be nominated as the candidate of the party. It was George Walker Bush, George Bush the first. All the rest of them. I mean, what happened to Dan Quayle? What happened to Nelson Rockefeller? What happened to Dick
is the
Cheney?
Democratic
what
track
happened
records- to? Is the Democratic track record so much better?
Absolutely. Every Democratic vice president gets nominated to be president. Al Gore, Hubert Humphrey, Walter Mondale, Joe Biden.
They at least get nominated and they get a fourth effort behind them. Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. So maybe J.D. Vance won't be nominated.
The Republicans don't even get nominated.
So I'm going to connect a couple of things here. You have mentioned before about how J.D. Vance talks about, so his wife, Usha, who is Indian American. Went to
God
law school with
woman.
Him.
I don't feel a lot for Melania, but I do feel for that woman. She feels like she's a prisoner.
So you went to Yale Law School. She clerked for Justice Roberts. Clearly a smart woman. Has three kids who are under the age of 9. She has a 2-year-old when this all started. Three kids, right? So this is already, I'm like, oh my God, that's a lot to carry.
Yeah.
J.D. Vance talks about them as her children. not ours, did an interview in which he talked about how he's Catholic and how he feels bad for his wife, who was raised Hindu, to come to church with him and bring her kids and raise them that way. And I'm just like, whoa, once again, are you guys on the same page about what's going on in your life? What's going on? Like, you're talking about empathy for your wife and her kids, but are you he not also on the said, same page about faith? Or like, what's going
remember
on
this
here?
From a week or so ago? Remember this, we talked about this? Remember this from a week or so ago where he said something like, you know, his wife who's got this great career, but then she's also got to like manage the kids and how like it's such a burden for her to have to do all this. Mm-hmm. And the whole time I'm sitting there like, you don't have any responsibility for like managing your kids? Nope. Like, but your wife's a full-fledged professional and she's got to both do that and completely manage like all the kids while you run around the country with this lunatic.
And for reference, this is not a boomer where that was societally what was going on. Jamal, he's younger than we are. And yes, this is one. I'm younger than you, Jamal, but JD Vance is young. I'm like, this is not how dudes are parenting these days who want anything that resembles a happy home life, right? That's just not how it's done. It's not sustainable. But then talking about her, she did that thing. What I can glean from all of this was this idea that Asian Americans, whether they're of the brown or the East Asian persuasion, right? We're talking about people who are descended from like, you know, half of the world in ethnicity. Have assumed that they can be race neutral, right? She could have proximity. Right. She did, like you said, I checked all the boxes. I did all the right things. I became the hyper-achieving superstar, blah, 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 blah. What do people say about her, right? What are the people in her party, especially the religious evangelical folks, what are they saying out loud, right? She's pagan, right? Like, this is not a first lady. You know, this is watering down our bloodline. I'm like, guys, this is not the place. This is not the group that is going to help you advance and grow. You bought into the lies about how to actually be happy and healthy and advance in American society. You were told if you just acted just like the J.D. Vances of the world, as a minority, man or woman, you could achieve, right? Nothing else could get in your way.
Here's what I don't understand as a man, and I'm going to be maybe traditionally male here for a minute, and you can push back on me about this. But we do fundamentally are raised. We are fundamentally raised to protect our families, to be the people in our households, to keep, make sure that, like, you know, if something breaks, try to fix it. If somebody is at the door, you know, you go downstairs and figure out like who it is in the middle of the night. What is that bump? I don't understand these guys, Ted Cruz, J.D. Vance, who sign up with Donald Trump, who attacks their wives, either in name or in culture, and are willing to pass by that without pumping that guy in the nose. Like, I just don't understand how you could sit there every day next to somebody who you know has disdain for the person who is supposed to be the closest person who is raising with you, your children, who is a part of your family, who you sleep with all the time, and then every night. Like, I don't understand how you allow that.
I mean, listen, keep my spouse's name out of your mouth. It starts with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. It starts with that. But that's not that. That's why this like masculinity discussion and conversation, I do find it very interesting, even though, once again, we're talking about men. Maybe it's better that we're talking about black men as a voter as opposed to white men. And I get it. It is. We're talking about the margins right now and not just marginalized communities writ large. So the margins in recent polling have been showing increasing support among black men for Donald Trump. As we've talked about together and on the show, there are 3 to 4 percentage points difference. It's within the margin of error of all the polling. Yeah. Generally, pollsters have done a shit job of understanding and polling women, period, writ large, right? So there's a lot of variables out
Especially since Dobbs.
Yes.
We've gotten it wrong.
I've been gaslit on television by male pollsters. They're like, no, abortion's not a big issue. No, that's not how women are voting and this and that. I'm like, okay, let's just see what happens at the state level. Yeah, like not a surprise.
Wait for it.
Just wait for it.
Wait for it.
The idea, though, that there is something that is resonating, and when you're looking at the everybody needs, both candidates now need enough of a slice of everything else to be able to get to a winning calculus in election math. Why is it an issue that the first actual black president, because people love to talk about Bill Clinton as the first black president, which is a conversation for another day.
Talking margins. About like how,
oh, yeah, why are about people how this upset? In the margins, why are people upset when the person of the community who had the highest leadership status, who was still highly popular in that community, is telling that community how he relates and how he feels about an issue? Like, is that not, granted, everyone saw it. And I kind of love that everybody can now see what used to be exclusively in community conversations. We can all see them. And if you're smart, you'll learn from that. I've learned a lot from watching conversations that are happening with another, like, you know, LGBTQ communities. I'm like, oh, okay, that these are the nuances of this. Why is everyone else all upset suddenly about Barack Obama telling black male voters, well, if your problem is misogyny, you need to get over it? Well, is this, what are you hearing and what are you feeling about? What are they upset about?
That's not what people are upset about. Well, maybe there are some people who are upset about that. What I have heard more of is, one, don't hold black men to a standard, or don't talk to black men in a way you don't talk to other people, right? So nobody's going to white Republican women, right, who are not voting for Kamala Harris and saying, cross finger, like, you need to vote for her if you're not voting for her. And remember, Donald Trump said this about
people did try that though with
Jewish
with,
people,
not with Republican,
and how
women.
That worked out.
Right, fair. I mean, out. Right, but like, yes, like the
nobody really wants to be lectured to.
When nobody Madeleine wants to Albright, be lectured to. When Madeleine Albright said, "Oh, there's a special place in hell for women who don't vote for women," I was like, "Excuse me, really?"
Exactly. Like, and really? That's how, like, okay. And that's how a lot of men felt. Like, maybe we have issues, and some of them might be sexism, but certainly some of them are sexism.
So it was like the
but
public some of them also call out. Are is it other the things. Public fact of it, and not the?
Well, yeah, there's that. The other thing is, I think Van Jones actually did this right. He said, "Look, Barack Obama for many of us is like our best achieving, like, a role model, right? Like, he's the one who's got a great family. He's had a great career. He's branching out in the business. He's innovative. He can play basketball and shoot three pointers, right? Yeah. Like, he's like this superhero sort of guy." And so when he chastises us, it feels like, or he criticizes us, it feels like chastising, and especially when he doesn't couple it with what I see about you. Right. I see you working hard. I see you trying to take care of your family. I see you battling racism every day. I see you being nervous when the police pull you over. And for those of you, not for all of you, but for those of you who have a problem that's based in sexism, that's not acceptable. Right. Okay. So that's just a different context where we don't go immediately to the critique. We start off with, you know what? You got a hard row. And I know that. But let me tell you what's also bad. You
and
can't
it's also
take
it's
your
public.
Hardship and
so
transfer
you're
that to how you
publicly
deal with it.
Without recognizing. So this is also apparently in leadership training, which I think then also applies to, you know, anything you do with children if you learn in leadership training. But the idea that if you're giving feedback or critique to a subordinate or somebody, really in general, you need it. The negative outweighs emotionally.
You hear the negative the louder, positive. Right?
Yeah, two to three times louder. And so the trick is, for every one negative, you got to say two to three positive. And it's not how most of us, right, are actually trained coming
up.
Like, well, you know,
it works
put up
in
with
marriages
it.
Too.
It does, actually. That's another conversation.
Yeah. Like, we'll do that another night, right?
I know.
I'm learning. Yeah. I'm learning, I'll tell you.
Yeah. And that goes beyond the idea of like words of affirmation or love languages. No, like literally way your body and your brain processes negative information is it sparks something different than the positive. So it's a bias towards we feel negative things about ourselves are more real than how we feel the positive. And so you're talking about a community, black men, that's already on the receiving end of so much negative public discussion. Okay, thank you. That actually helps me understand it better because I looked at it and thought about it. It's like, well, all right, it's like big black dude who's made a big deal talking to other black dudes, since everybody in America right now seems to feel comfortable talking about black dudes and as voters, as opposed to any other time when you've talked about them in history.
It's also that Barack Obama, you know, for those of us who are like of a certain age, we remember 2008, we remember how important Barack Obama as a political and historic figure was. But you got to think about it. Like I had a 26-year-old woman who worked for me when I was at the White House, and I said something about the 2008 campaign, and she looked at me and she goes, "I kind of remember that. I mean, I was in middle school when that happened." I realized, like, oh my gosh, I'm really that old. But nobody under the age of 30 has ever voted for Barack Obama before.
Yeah, that's the reality.
As if if you've got a 35 and under problem, right? Your problem is with 35 and under men. Barack Obama's not somebody they have the same kind of emotional connection with.
Is that what the data is showing right now? That when it comes to the data about black male voters, it's younger black male voters, right? Because
it's mostly, yeah.
It's not millennials.
There are some middle-aged men for sure, but right. It's younger African-Americans across genders, but particularly mm-hmm. younger African-American men, where she's like at 67% or something like that. Yeah, like it's really low.
Which does connect with what I've heard anecdotally in the classroom. So I do teach twice a week, undergraduates and graduates, but even the graduate students are still largely below the age of 30. And they mm-hmm. have grown up post-Obama, mm-hmm. terrible economic circumstances. They know that being able to live on their own, afford a house, all of this, right? Economic promises, the same things do not work that work for now their grandparents or even their parents, right? Like we were still in the cusp of, okay, if I get a student loan, I still got the college degree. That'll help me get a leg ahead. They're like, nah, y'all are still paying your student loans. Y'all don't have a house that you could afford and you're still struggling. So like, what are you trying to tell me that this is a good way to proceed? On top of that, they have seen a massive decline in American standing on the world stage. Post-Iraq War, post-Afghanistan, right? Everything available online, very easy. This is no longer an environment where foreign policy is filtered through diplomats and very, like everybody in America can now see globally what is happening and make those connections. And then the third point is this really does get underestimated, climate change. I have heard from so many students like, well, you know, the earth is dying. And I'm shocked at how many of them are actually optimistic that in the maybe the next 10 years they can do something about it, 10 or 15 years. And again, these are people in college or graduate students who care already about public policy. If those folks are already this jaded, I can only imagine what a broader social grouping of younger people does. So does that is universally a failure, right? Of what I would say boomers who set up the post-New Deal era, the liberal world order, the folks who set that up, if their grandkids are so disheartened about what is possible with the American promise, there's a failure there, right? That is a legacy failure. Is the
I think social media is a part of this. I think sometimes how we raised our kids to be like a little bit more like we are excited when they like jump up and down three times and we're like, yay, you jumped up and down three times. we talked about this the other day. But there is something that is like ideologically pure about them, right? Yeah. And so hypocrisy is much more is much more impactful for them in a way. And we have more opportunities to see hypocrisy, right?
That's so what it is.
It's technology has made it like obvious when something happens. And you think about the institutions, if you think about the last 25 years or so, like all these institutions that have failed, like the Catholic Church, you know, and like abuse, we've had this Balco problem, like sports where like drugging and all that stuff has happened in sports. We've seen the housing crisis, man, you know, and Wall Street almost fail. You know, we've had this, like this one thing after another where these people who were supposed to know it all, right, got it wrong, and the society, we had a pandemic, right? Where people couldn't figure out how to manage it.
All these people
were supposed to be the smart ones and figure out how to manage it, failed. And you so for and them, I, why should they have confidence in us? Like, we're just screwing it up.
You and I are paying for into Social Security, which we probably might not ever be able to collect, but that's, I mean, listen, I'm glad seniors, my parents, again, sandwich generation, I loved that Harris brought that up because that is where we are in our age range of sandwiched between elder care and child care. And elders will have their Social Security. Those systems will be there. But it was designed by them to borrow on the backs of us. It's not going to be around for me. It's not going to be around for my kids, right? So we started to see that.
I mean, the idea was that we would have a way to keep doing it. But first of all, the good news is people are living longer. I mean, Social Security was only supposed to last for like 5 to 10 years. Right. Like everybody kind of be dead by 75. So it didn't really matter. But now people are living to be 90. So that's like a different, you know, you could be retired for like 25, 30 years. So that's a different system. And the Republicans won't increase
taxes. If you actually leave your job and retire.
Yeah,
maybe make room for a younger generation of leaders who are not young anymore.
If you taxed people over, like, I think the threshold is like in the 100-something thousands. If you taxed income, all income for Social Security, you could solve the problem, right? Or even like not even all income, but just like another $100,000 of income, you could probably solve the Social Security problem.
But
Republicans won't let us tax anything for any reason.
Well, the Trump tax cuts do expire in 2025. So this is a big deal. There could suddenly be a lot of money coming in to help fund all of these programs that we're talking about that we all need and we all like, that could come from the people who have just been getting a pass.
So this isn't on our talk sheet, but I want to go here for a second because you're making a really good point, is the Trump tax cuts will be expired. And then we go back to an era before the Trump tax cuts. But you know what the era was before the Trump tax cuts? It was the era of the Bush tax cuts, right? So this is the thing about conservatives. Conservatives just keep moving the ball further and further in their direction, while we just keep, it seems like on the left, are just playing defense and trying to stop them from doing all the bad things. Where is the offense for us? Where's the point where we start saying, I mean, I guess there are people who are trying to do it, AOC and others, the Green New Deal, which people kind of lambast. But like, we have to start saying, let's have a vision for what the earth looks like, what the society looks like when we're in charge and our values are the predominant ones, not just us playing defense against your aggression against the rest of us.
One of my favorite data points about the military-industrial complex is the Eisenhower Institute. General Eisenhower, as president, right? Reconstruction after World War II, knitting all the stuff together. The general himself said, this is the military-industrial complex. It will get out of hand, right? This is no longer about a lefty liberal thing about being anti-war. It is just a reality of how we have structured our society and where public money goes. And I will tell you, the young people know. I have students who identify and register as Republican who are like, we got to cut the military budget. You would never have heard that 30 years ago. So there is the shifting of what's happening, of what is considered right and left. We're living that right now. But I actually really do. I find a lot of hope in the young folks. They're, like you said, hypocrisy matters to them. They will call it out for what it is, but they do have a set of values and their starting point of what is considered right and moral for society and how we treat each other is much higher than what we were given. So I'm like, just let them do it.
Want to button up one thing. Absolutely. I'm going to button up one thing because here's a place where they won and I think they deserve credit, right? So we started this before we take off. We started this about African-American men. What happened with black men? Well, one thing we know happened, black men won the day this week. The desire of these black men to say, we want more policy. We want concrete objectives. We want you to come to us and woo us the way you woo every other community in the country. We want you to come to us, Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, and give us something that's real. And this week, we saw the Vice President of the United States put out an opportunity agenda for black men. And in there, she had things about, you know, loans for startups, pathways for education, home ownership to deal with health. We don't talk about sickle cell and prostate and all the things that tend to affect black men in a way that they don't affect, they affect more than white men. So she had an agenda that really lays all that out. I think it's time now for all of us who've been saying, where are the black men? Go out there, sell this to these guys, let them know what this agenda is, and then say, you know what? We have got to, you're not going to be taken for granted. And if you stand up and say what you want, somebody will come to you with a real life agenda. And when they support you, it's time for you to support them. Well, right? You got to show them that if they support you, you support them. And now is that time. I'd rather have that conversation with these guys than have a conversation about what you're supposed to do because everybody told you is what you're supposed to do.
Fair. Completely get that. But that goes back to where we started, which is when people say, oh, well, what are you going to do for me? Is that really what they're asking for as a policy prescription? It is good to have. You need to have it. You need to be able to pivot to it and point to it and say it. But what they're ultimately saying is, I don't feel that you got my back. And how you address the feeling is not with facts. You need those. And that to me is fascinating from every community. It's just like that weird feeling we have. How Donald Trump has managed to give people feelings that they will act on is fascinating. But it works, right? Like that's clearly like he gave different segments and different minority groups the feeling that, ooh, you're right. Maybe some of the people that, you know, I've been in community with or I identify with, maybe they don't really have my back, right? And just understand what that whisper in your ear does to you. And that's, I think that's the, right, trying to combat that is the feeling and the emotion part that needs to go with the factual basis. Like really, but do you really think that guy has your back? we'll see. Jamal, love talking to you. I know we both got to get running with the rest of our days and families and everything. And I hope we will catch up again soon. And obviously, people, everybody else, can you make sure you sign, register, click on numbers and lines and subscription things and stars? We do. I like five. I like five stars.
Five stars. And follow us on YouTube and Apple Podcasts, all the places you get podcasts. Is that right? Yes. Am I getting this right, Nayar?
I think we got it right. All right. I think we Politicon. Just, we want to hear you, from you guys. We want to hear from everybody who's been sitting here listening to us the whole time. And that way we can keep you in the loop. Thank you, everyone.
All right. Ciao. See you next week.